Hello, and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, the podcast where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. Every week here on the podcast, we invite a new female filmmaker, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, and today we have filmmaker Natasha Kermani. Hello, Natasha.
Hi, Katie. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about this movie with you. So a little bit about Natasha. Iranian-American writer and director Natasha Kermani is a native New Yorker based in LA and the co-founder of Ilium Pictures. A graduate of NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, Natasha's credits include the horror satire Lucky, which is playing at Night Dream, and the science fiction feature film Imitation Girl. Her short form work includes the very first live action short film of beloved manga series Battle Angel Alita. Kermani has directed a variety of commercial content for clients, including NYDJ, Thinks, Microsoft, Third Love, Vox Creative, and Condé Nast Entertainment. Outside of film and television, Natasha is a violinist and composer who enjoys playing live shows with local bands and ensembles. So, Natasha, today you chose to talk about the amazing Kathryn Bigelow futuristic, crazy sci-fi movie, Strange Days, from 1995. So, why'd you pick this movie? What's the appeal of Strange Days?
Yeah, I fell in love with this movie really early, and I found it actually because I had sort of gone through every other piece of science fiction film at the local library and the local video store, and I finally picked it up. And yeah, I think it was a really seminal experience for me because it is just such a muscular film. And I knew who Kathryn Bigelow was. I had seen, of course, Point Break, and some of her other stuff, but I didn't really understand her as a filmmaker until I saw this film. And just the way she did what she needed to do with this movie. And it is just so real. It is so, again, muscular is the word that I use the most, with it. So yeah, I'm excited to sort of talk about, you know, enjoying it as a fan and also sort of looking at it as, you know, sort of a flag bearer for the kind of work that I'm interested in and the kind of work that I'm interested in putting out into the world. And lastly, I just feel it's, you know, unfortunately more relevant than ever, this movie.
I just rewatched it in May because I was rewatching all of Bigelow's films. And actually, it was the first time I had seen it because it's impossible to watch.
Yes.
It's on DVD. It's not on streaming anywhere. I read that, you know, because James Cameron's obviously a producer and a screenwriter, but he keeps saying he's going to restore, you know, The Abyss and True Lies and all these films that he produced, but he's completely caught up in Avatar land. So he hasn't got around to restoring them, but there's no Blu-ray of this film. It's not on streaming. And
very difficult to find.
It's very difficult to find. So I had not seen it until this year, and I was sort of shocked by how prescient it was. And how alive and vital. And as you say, it's so muscular and it's unflinching in a way that's, I think, really interesting. I think that I found, you know, the violence against women to be quite hard to take. But like Bigelow has said, she's like, I don't want, like, people need to know. And like, I'm not going to not show violence because you need to be aware of it. And I think there is a commentary on the way in which we consume violence against women in this film that is challenging but really important. And I think that
your film,
Lucky, totally takes that on in the same way.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're very different tones, obviously. But yeah, I am very interested in violence as a concept and as something that, you know, is something that we really need to discuss and not sort of turn away from. And this film absolutely does not turn away from violence.
And there's a quote from Bigelow that I'll just share before we get into the synopsis. But in approaching how to show violence, she says, "My challenge was to approach it in as cold and honest a light as I could. I included it because knowledge is power. The answer is not to shield one's vision and cut oneself off from awareness. There's nothing more dangerous than lack of awareness." So I think that in a film that is, I think, one of her first films that really includes like a social message, you can really see that starting to come through for her in wanting to talk about issues about how we consume violence and violence against women, and also, you know, the riots that are going on the streets of LA. But before we get into all the nitty-gritty details, I am going to do a quick synopsis of the film, as we always do. And remember, if you haven't seen Strange Days, this episode will contain spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like we always say, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. But if you want to pause this episode, go to eBay, purchase a DVD, as I did.
Buy a DVD player, because I know nobody has one anymore.
I don't have DVD players anymore. Side note, like, I feel like an ancient person for having a DVD player.
It's been years. I got rid of mine a long time ago. I think when I moved, years ago.
Yeah.
But sorry, I derailed you.
No, it's okay. this is my little quibble. Hit me up if you have a DVD player, so I know I'm not the only one. Anyway. Watch the movie, go to the library, like you said, you know, watch it, pause it, come back to the episode. Now's your chance. Okay, so Strange Days, written by James Cameron and Jay Cox and directed by Kathryn Bigelow for release in 1995, Strange Days stars Ralph Fiennes as a former LAPD officer and now squid peddler. He buys and sells implanted memories for people to experience themselves on a proto-VR headset. When we meet Lenny, it's 2 days before New Year's Eve 1999, and as he's seeking out one such memory clip, a brutal robbery, it ends in death, something he refuses to deal in.
God damn it, you know I don't deal in snuff!
I don't have a fucking coronary.
Well, you could have at least warned me. You know I hate the zat. When they die, it just brings down your whole day.
Meanwhile, a woman named Iris is running from the cops. She gets away, but they discover she's wearing a squid recorder headset. Whatever happened for them to chase her has already been recorded and uploaded. Iris drops a mini disc of that recording in Lenny's car as he's having a drink with his PI buddy Max, played by Tom Sizemore.
Tequila, four before, double shots. Make it a tray. I don't see how. Nothing but the best. My good friend Lenny.
Funnest cop to ever get thrown off the vice squad.
She tries to get his attention, but has to run from the cops.
Hey, Iris, you okay?
I gotta talk to you, Lenny. It's serious.
What happened, honey? Some giant get rough on you or something?
No, let me talk private. Please, I'm in trouble.
And Lenny's car gets towed. Luckily, his old friend Mace, played by Angela Bassett, a chauffeur and security expert, is around for him to hitch a ride.
Hey, you passed La Cienega.
That would imply I'm not taking La Cienega.
Yeah, but it's the quickest way to get to the club.
I gotta get to the club. I got business there. I'm meeting people. Mace, you're my friend. I need you. Plus, I'll give you 25% of what I make tonight.
You know, this may be a hard concept for you, but friends don't have to pay their friends.
Lenny convinces one of her high-profile clients to go to a club so he can get a free ride to see his ex, Faith, played by Juliette Lewis, perform with her band. At the club, Lenny picks up a mystery squid disc and tries to get Faith away from her new boyfriend, record exec Philo, who's played by Michael Wincott, and fails. Everyone's a little on edge because Philo's revolutionary rapper client, Jericho One, Glenn Plummer, was found murdered in an apparent gang shooting.
Police earlier said that the killings appear to be gang-related. With his band, Prophets of Light, Jericho One's outspoken political stance and violent lyrics have stirred nationwide controversy.
Later, Lenny watches the squid disc, which turns out to be a disturbing POV video of Iris's rape and murder. Lenny realizes Iris left something for him in his car, so he and Mace try to break into the impound lot and retrieve a disc. Two officers show up and try to kill them, but they escape. On the disc is Iris's POV, watching those same two cops murder Jericho Run. Mace wants to release the tape to the public, but Max says it would start a war and that the LAPD has death squads readying. Lenny says they'll need to find Faith because if she knows anything about the tape, she'll be murdered next. At the club where they find her, Faith reveals that Philo put the squid recorder on Iris to keep tabs on Jericho One, and he doesn't want anyone knowing he kept his artist under surveillance.
He's such a control freak now. He's been having people followed. He's recording his business partner's phone calls. He's wiring up people left and right. Philo and Jericho weren't getting along. He was afraid Jericho was going to dump him, but he wasn't sure. So he starts with the surveillance. A couple of nights ago, he wires up Iris and he sends her and the other girl, Diamanda, over to Jericho's table.
Lenny and Mace sneak into Philo's swanky New Year's Eve party, and finally, Lenny agrees with her that they should slip the tape to the police commissioner. Pursued by Philo's goons, Lenny heads to the penthouse where he finds Philo brain dead on the floor and yet another squid disc, which turns out to be a recording of Max and Faith staging her rape, which also reveals that the two have been lovers. This is the tape that quote-unquote fried Philo's brain. Faith ultimately reveals to Lenny that Philo hired Max to murder Iris, but he also wanted Faith dead as a part of the cover-up. And now Max wants to frame Lenny for the murders.
So I'm working for this puke, right? And he says he'll pay me quite large to do the hooker. But I also got to do his bitch girlfriend because she knows the whole score and she's totally out of control. Only he doesn't know about me and Faith. So I say to myself, if I turn the job down, he just gets somebody else. And I lose Faith, to coin a phrase. So to buy some time, I do this gank, but I still got to deal with Gant. I figure it's him or me. But I can't just camp him without some chump take the fall. And who better than his girlfriend's loser ex boyfriend, known criminal, and who has been seen hassling him in public numerous times.
And was regrettably also your best fucking friend.
And no plan is perfect, Lenny.
But Lenny fights back, and Max falls to his death from the balcony of the hotel. Mace, meanwhile, is trying to give the police commissioner the Jericho murder tape, but she's chased by two dirty cops into the giant rave on the streets occurring outside of the hotel. She's able to fight the cops and cuff them, but the other cops join in on the beating and a riot starts. Eventually, a good cop saves her and Mace and Lenny kiss under a cloud of falling confetti. That was very complicated. It's a very complicated plot.
Yeah.
But we get the idea. It's about these murders that are captured on VR headsets, which to me are like body cam footage, the body cam footage that we watch now constantly on social media. And the riot at the end is so connected to Rodney King. And obviously, you know, Cameron came up with this idea in 1986, and then he eventually gave it to Catherine Bigelow, and she was incorporating all of the things that were going on in her world. And she has said that she was involved in a lot of the cleanup and stuff after the riots. And I think that was really affecting her. And she also mentioned the Lorena Bobbitt trial, and they were also shooting during the O.J. Simpson trial. And that was just, there was so much unrest. So clearly all of these things are percolating and she's commenting on them directly in the film. But, you know, what's a shame is that this movie was made for $42 million and it only made 7.9. So it was definitely a failure. In Catherine Bigelow's career. And then after this, she made a film called...
It almost ended her career.
Yeah, it almost ended.
That was almost the end.
Yeah. So it took about 5 years for her to make her next film, which is The Weight of Water, which no one has seen, but it is wacky and totally worth watching.
Yeah, it's cool.
And then she, 10 years later, she made The Hurt Locker, which obviously became a resurgence in her career for her. She won Best Director. And she's obviously doing great. But yeah, this movie almost took her out, which is crazy considering it is such a fascinating, forward-thinking, incredibly well-made movie. I mean, the technically it is impeccable. And she did so much technological...
And innovative.
And innovative, yes. And she did so much sort of... Like she was developing lightweight cameras to capture those POV shots, and they were choreographing like the opening squid tape that Lenny watches, which is the burglary. The burglary, yes. I mean, that would they took years to choreograph that thing because one of the stunt guys jumps from one roof to another without a safety harness, and so they had to incorporate like Steadicam and a headset.
There's a lot of invisible seams.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting to me, like, I'm curious, I watched your Battle Angel Alita short, which was sort of this, like, very, very cool sort of short action piece. And there's a lot of fight choreography in Lucky. And I'm so curious, like, are you interested in action filmmaking or how do you approach these fight scenes and choreography as a filmmaker?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that stuff. I think, you know, it is a really cool technical challenge, right? So it's really forces you to be on your A game to, first of all, bring something innovative to a fight, right? So to treat each fight as a unique emotional experience for the audience, right? So no two fights should really be the same. And sort of making sure that your filmmaking is reflecting that. I mean, to take it a step back, I I first came to this film, I think I was like in college or something, and when I found it. And, you know, I grew up reading William Gibson and science fiction and adventure and all this kind of stuff. And so when I first watched it, I was really engaged with it in that sense. So I was really watching it for the science fiction. I was watching it for the action. I was watching it for the love story, the love triangle, and all of that stuff. And I really think that the film has, I've grown with the film. So past sort of that, the William Gibson-esque-ness of it, into realizing that this is all of the action, all of the camera tricks, all of this stuff is in service to this perspective that she's trying to offer up. So this is my long-winded way of saying, I think it's interesting to come to action with that in mind. What is the bigger picture? So for example, putting together the choreography for something that's an adaptation of a manga is going to be very, very different than what we did with Lucky. So with Lucky, first of all, I found a female stunt coordinator, which was incredibly important to me.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, just to sort of understand movement and, also the broader idea, you know, one of the first things we really spoke about was violence against women. And we're bringing this to the screen and we want to present it in a way that is, yes, part of the larger story, but also always conscious that this is a real thing that women experience every day. So that larger context. And then on a more micro scale, it was important to us that Bria's character, May, was not a super badass. As compared to the manga thing, right? Which is she's a super badass. So that's going to be super different. So with May, it's she's not trained. She's just sort of reacting in the moment. And so she's going to be messier. It's going to be clumsier. She's going to have to really depend on luck to help her out. It even impacted our choice of casting for the villain. Because initially we had been looking at these big dudes, these big like MMA guys. It was actually one of our producers who brought up, you know, Bria's quite small. Yeah. And she would just be immediately destroyed by these big dudes. So, you know, we should maybe expand our search to find somebody who's a little bit more her size. And of course that sent my brain going in a totally different direction. The whole vibe, costume, everything for the villain character completely changed off of that one very grounded logistical action choice. Which is, does it make sense that this 5'2 woman would be able to defend herself against this person? So again, I'm babbling a little bit, but I think the point is always coming to it from a grounded perspective, and that you're servicing the overall tone and unity of your story.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk more about Strange Days with Natasha Kermani.
Hey, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. Together, we're The Flophouse,
a podcast where we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Movies like Space Hobos, Into the Outer Reaches of the Unknown and the Things That We Don't Know, the movie, and also Who's That Grandma?
Zazzle Zippers, Breakdown 2, and Backhanded Compliment.
Elvis is a Policeman.
Baby Crocodile and the Happy Twins.
Leftover Potatoes?
Station Wagon 3.
Herbie Goes to Hell.
New episodes available every other Saturday.
Available at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bye. Bye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh, and I'm here talking to Natasha Kermani about Strange Days. So one of the other things I wanted to talk about was sort of the like self-conscious genre play that Bigelow is incredibly known for. She talks about genre a lot, and I think people ask her about genre a lot because she's making a cowboy vampire movie, and then she makes a sci-fi movie, and then she makes a war movie, and then she makes, you know, erotic thriller slash... period piece, The Weight of Water. She makes a submarine movie. I don't think any other woman has made a submarine movie.
No, that's so dope.
She's my idol, but...
Same.
She has said, you know, playing with genre is both conscious and unconscious because I don't think you're ever immune to genre. Even if you mm-hmm. choose not to use it, that's a loaded decision in and of itself. But I have a desire to subvert and redefine. Genre exists for that purpose. It's a great interlocutor with the audience, a way in, a language they understand and that makes them comfortable. Once you touch base in a genre, you can go in any direction. So she's really using it as a tool, a filmmaking tool, storytelling tool. And I felt a similar way about Lucky, which to me was this, like, I love slasher movies. They're my absolute favorite horror genre. And I thought this was a really interesting take on the slasher movie and especially the final girl and Bria's character, May, who's this final girl, but she just has to keep doing it every night. There's nothing.
<It's exhausting. laughs>
So I'm curious, like, when you got the script for Lucky, like, what were your thoughts? Like, how did you and Bria sort of approach reinventing the slasher?
Yeah, I always saw it as a satire. I always saw it as a Twilight Zone episode yeah. version of a slasher film, which was much more interesting. I think I was much more interested in playing in that space than playing in a straight slasher space. So to sort of have that extra layer of self-awareness and looking through that sort of like twisted black mirror at how a slasher movie is put together was a really interesting challenge for me. And obviously Bria knows the genre so well that we came, you know, the minute I read the script, I immediately understood, right? And I could see her in that role and I understood how she would bring May to life as a version of the final girl. I mean, I sort of jokingly call her the final woman.
Yes, of course.
She's grown.
Yes, yes.
She is grown and she is like dealing with the real shit, right? So like, what is intersectional feminism look like, right? Like, why is this white woman the final girl? You know, and starting to look at all of those things that exist in slasher movies. I think that was much more interesting to me when I read that script than a lot of the other scripts I was reading at the time. So yeah, definitely conscious. Absolutely. And I think for Bria, it was less about the filmmaking as it was the idea of bringing that that emotion to the screen. So that feeling of like when you are in that place and you are faced with these very real problems and the world around you is starting to twist and fall apart. And because she was coming to it with that very intense personal emotion that she was trying to share, it has that emotional grounding. And then everything I'm saying, all this bullshit, satire of a slasher, blah, 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 blah. It's all icing. Right. Like what it really comes from her experience and her sharing that experience on the screen and honoring that experience and making sure that those stakes were always there. So you can make fun of things. You can ask how to look at things. But at the end of the day, a slasher is about a very real trauma and it's about a very real fear and that idea of being hunted. And so I say that as a caveat to everything else about, you know, Twilight Zone and all this and all that. The stakes still have to be grounded and they still have to be real.
I totally felt that way about the film, that Bria's character was the grounded reality, emotional reality, at least, aspect of what's going on. And through as the film proceeds, you sort of are like, what's happening? And I think it's really interesting the way that you both, you know, play with that and how you represent this idea of, is she like, is this really happening or like what's going on? And because everyone around her is questioning her and gaslighting her. And, but you constantly are present with her experience of what's happening. And I think that Mace, a character that we've talked about a lot in Strange Days, is also the grounded reality version. I think you mentioned this earlier, like, she's the one who, as a woman and as a Black woman in Los Angeles during this time, like, she's like, I understand the dangers of what's going on here. And Lenny is kind of like in La La Land. I mean, he's
completely,
you know, he's in Squid World. Like
he's living in
memory and in fantasy.
Talking about his clothes. He's like, this tie doesn't go with the shirt. I love it. It's like, bro, fucking get it together. Smack, smack.
I know. And so, you know, I think that dichotomy within the film is so important. And I love that Bigelow sort of like gives us these two people playing off of each other of like, here's the real thing. And you actually very much believe that Mace is this incredible security character or security expert and chauffeur and everything, because she's like highly vigilant and she's like hyper vigilant all the time, looking around. And like Lenny is like, God knows where he is, like in his mind. You know, is he fantasizing? Is he living in memory? Is he like, you know, taking in these sort of snuff films? Like what is going on with him? But that dichotomy between fantasy and reality is, I think, something that Bigelow has talked about a lot in this film, and mentioning that Mace is the grounded reality character and Lenny is the fantasy character. And I think that's like a really interesting element to play with in sci-fi and in horror, and how you present something that where reality is something that you're questioning a little bit.
There's a really cool William Gibson novel called Idoru that is sort of takes place in a similar, it's the same world as Neuromancer, and actually plays with a lot of the same themes. And, you know, a lot of the dynamics, I'm sure Bigelow and Cameron were fans of Neuromancer and Idoru, because a lot of that character Mace is similar to characters from that world. And they have these very vulnerable male characters who are not your hero, right? And they're just dealing with their own shit. And then you have these women who, you know, Mace is, she's powerful, but she's also incredibly soft, right? So we take the time to see her looking at her son playing outside. Mm-hmm. And we see a softness, and we understand that she's doing everything to protect her son. We see her capable, but we also see her vulnerable. And, you know, she looks great in a suit at the beginning of the movie, and she looks fucking great at the end of the movie when she's in a sparkly New Year's Eve dress. So and it's so simple.
Sorry, I'm obsessed with her like delts. She's so powerful.
She's ridiculous. But it's, and it's such a simple thing. But when you really think about it, we don't see it. We don't fucking see it. And so I think she's really revolutionary. And I think Lenny is revolutionary.
Yes.
And there's an interesting choice where, you know, Cameron wanted like a much more slick guy for Lenny. And Bigelow went with Fiennes because she had seen him in Schindler's List, of all things.
Yeah.
But I think she understood that he could bring that complexity. But I have a very superficial comment, which is he's super hot. Like he's just attractive. And if fucking Lenny is not attractive, the movie doesn't work. Right. If he's a slick piece of shit, why the fuck would Mace bother herself?
Right.
He's got to have something, some softness, some attractive quality to him. And so it's these like really basic things that I think are often overlooked that she just nails in it.
Yeah. Bigelow has the best taste in men. I just want to put that
out
there.
Truly. Swayze and Keanu, like, ridiculous.
You know, you have Cameron writing this treatment and this script. And we know Cameron loves a powerful woman. And he loves his Ripley's. He loves his Sarah Connors. He loves, you know, every strong, powerful woman. But I think that what Bigelow brings to this is the balance and the push and pull between the powerful woman and the man. And like that she sort of has a weakness for him in a way. She's not just like, you know, Ripley, like, you know, burning
the
all
thrower.
The alien alien pods and aliens. But you know, there's a softness, again, that you said, you know, that that is in the Lenny character that sort of softens her and you know, her background as well that softens her. But I think there's much more of a complex dynamic than just one or the other.
It's exactly complex. And actually, to go back to the quote that you said earlier about her desire to bend genre, that was a tongue twister. I think that it's harder to do. And I think the fact that this movie did not do well in the box office at the time is proof of that, right? So did she push the genre too far? Did people go into this theater expecting like a rock and roll sci-fi movie about VR and shoot 'em up? And then they got this like incredibly thoughtful, challenging film about violence and race relations in the fucking mid-90s LA. So, you know, I think that that's a really interesting lesson, and I'm fascinated by it because I exist in a world where I want to make challenging work. And yet somebody's got to foot the bill and we want people to see it. And you don't want to spend $40 million on a movie and make seven. You just don't. So I don't know what the answer is, but I know that this is something that she went through. And yeah, I don't know what you think. It's that everlasting question, because she made a phenomenal film that didn't do well.
You know, I think sometimes it's so hard to understand like why movies didn't do well at the time. But I almost wonder if like people were a little tired of thinking about these challenging ideas, like about race. And if they were just like, we want something escapist, like we want Keanu Reeves, like with a bomb on the bus. You know what I mean? Like
great this, movie, but very great movie.
I adore Speed, but you know, it's escapist. It has a happy ending and it's like, yay, they did it. They didn't blow up the bus. But I think I wonder if people did not want to be as challenged as this movie challenges them in terms of thinking about what we consume, how we consume, the role of corrupt police and police brutality. I mean, this is even a question, like, we can't even accept that today. Like, we can't even accept that the police are corrupt today. And Catherine's back there in 1995 saying, look at this. These police are murdering wantonly. So I wonder if it's just a question of, we want to put our blinders on and we want to escape into fantasy worlds. So, but yeah.
I mean, that's where the horror, I think that's where the horror community actually comes in, because I think the horror community is more open to being challenged than the broader mass audience. So I think that is a role that, you know, we as people who love horror films are able to fill, right? And we can explore those nooks and crannies because we are a little more open to it, and we actually embrace, you know, challenging content.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk more about Strange Days with Natasha Kermani.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh, and I'm here talking to Natasha Kermani about Strange Days. Going back to something you mentioned much earlier in the conversation about the casting of the bad guy, I kind of love that he's just very average size look. He's just a guy who's not a big scary monster. He's not abnormal in any way, but he is just the most sort of, and it could be anyone, dude.
That's exactly it. That's the intention. Could be anyone.
Right. It's not like someone that you see, you know, he probably would look rather normal if he was walking down the street with, if he wasn't wearing that mask. but you know, like, I think there's a lot.
Well, even
of,
the mask, sorry, actually,
no,
just
go
to go
ahead.
To the
I
mask
would love
design,
to talk about the mask.
Part of the mask design actually is that maybe you don't necessarily realize that there's something wrong at first. So, you know, you sort of get the sense that there's something off about this guy's face, but it's certainly not like a scream mask or anything that from a distance you immediately raise an alarm. The whole intent behind the design of the mask is that it's a more subtle experience of realizing, oh, there's something off here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love so that mask design because it is so creepy, but again, it's done in a very subtle way. It's not a melted William Shatner mask, that's for sure.
which is effective, but also, you know, and Bria and I talk about this a lot, but like, you know, that's been done.
Right, exactly.
So what haven't we seen? And I actually wanted him to be like almost a little bit posh. One of our big influences is Mads Mikkelsen's Hannibal from the TV show.
Oh, yes.
And then sort of incorporating these more traditional things. So like the man's color is red. So red light often appears when he's in frame in opposition to May's blue light, right? So even his coat is not actually black. It's a maroon. So it's got sort of like red tone within it. You know, it's those more subtle nods to the traditional genre stuff, but scaled way down and made way more subtle because that is the experience that we're talking about, which is a very subtle, insidious thing that we're talking about experience.
I wanted to ask a little bit about, I think it's so interesting that May is a sort of self-help author and she's, like you said, she's not the final girl. She's the final woman. Like she's a successful person. And she sort of seems very flabbergasted that she has to deal with this. And she's like, I just want to do my career, you know?
I know, it's so funny.
Figure that out, you know? And yeah. It's, you know, as someone who is a, you know, would be a final woman, not a final girl. I was like, I deeply relate to her. Like, why do I have to put up with this bullshit?
Yeah.
So, you know, what was that, you know, obviously that was probably in Bria's script, but you know, like how did you kind of draw that out in your filmmaking and development?
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was funny as hell. Like, I thought it was so funny. And making the book covers with Bria's face. I mean, it's just funny. It's inherently funny. So I appreciated that sort of levity. But more seriously, the real thing here is that this is a woman who sells herself. She makes a living by saying, I have the answers.
Yes.
I will help you. And in the end, of course, she can't even help herself, right? So her monologue to her assistant is like, look, we're all on our own. You know, good luck, right?
Yeah.
Bye. And so I think that worked really nicely into the overall theme. And I know Bria is just sort of fascinated by the idea of self-help professionals.
Yeah.
I think that she's very funny. Bria is very funny. And so I think she sees a lot of the potential for humor in that idea of having a final woman who is, you know, again, claims to have all the answers, but in fact has nothing.
Yeah. By the time you see her books at the beginning of the film, and then when they come back towards the end and it's like, go it alone, you have to laugh at the title and how it's incorporating into what she's experiencing. So I loved that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point. The whole point of the movie is that, you know, it is a tragedy because she has so many opportunities throughout the film to reach out and make a connection with another woman. And at each opportunity, she is not able to, right? So for one reason or another, she is completely incapable of not going it alone, right? Like actually reaching out and going through this problem together, which really resonated for me because I think that that's a very real thing that, you know, as women, we have to really look at ourselves with a critical light and ask why, you know, what am I doing to help someone else? What am I doing to strengthen our community? What am I doing to make the world better and not just be thinking about our own survival or our own success rate or whatever it might be? So I think that's one of the tougher themes of the film.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to flinch away from it at all. I mean, the whole parking garage sequence is pretty damning.
Yes. Yes.
It really doesn't let May get away with, you know, what ends up being a shortcoming in her character. So.
Right. And if we're all fighting our own battles on our own and not looking around and seeing the battles that everyone else is fighting, I mean, that's sort of a day-to-day reality that we all deal with.
Absolutely.
Well, before we end, is there anything else about Strange Days that you want to talk about that we haven't gotten to yet? Any details or performances or things that really stuck with you on your first viewing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, saying that like I grew with the film, I would say, you know, from being a teenager, I was very affected by the Jericho One tape. So when you finally see Jericho's death, his murder, you know, it affected me. But watching it now in 2020, it is so difficult to watch. And the anxiety that you feel watching that is the anxiety that we're all experiencing.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that she made something in 1995 that has only become more emotionally intense is so fucking important.
Yes.
And it means that she was doing something real. And again, she does not flinch. That scene does not fucking flinch. It's a single shot. It's all real time. And like you said, it's the body cam thing. And so, you know, I think he says a line, Jericho has a very little screen time, but it's every word that he says in that movie is so important. And I think he says at one point, he's like, man, they're rearranging the chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah.
Right. Like the ship is going down. So anyway, I feel like if people have an opportunity to check this film out, I think that it, you're really going to get a lot out of it. And understand that this is the same shit, you know, the movie's not fucking 1995 and we're still here.
But it is amazing that this movie is so fresh and so relevant 25 years later. It's a shame they didn't restore it and re-release it for this year, because I definitely watched it in May, and then obviously the Black Lives Matter movement caught even more fire in the beginning of June, at the end of May. And it just feels like it predicted everything.
It did. And it also has this incredible, it turns a mirror on us living in 2020. I think there's a conversation between Mace and Lenny where, you know, this Black woman is telling Lenny, like, wake the fuck up.
Absolutely. Yes.
You're living in the past. You're living in a memory. It doesn't matter. We're here right now. And even that line in today's context is like, whoa, these people were on some next level shit in 1995 because they're speaking directly to me through this movie.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I just think that's what we all strive for, is to create a piece of work that can speak to people.
Absolutely. And that can be that timeless and that enduring and that, I mean, listen, like I'm sure Kathryn Bigelow does not want her film to be as relevant today as it was relevant in 1995, because it just means that we haven't figured this out yet.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's a damn shame. And I think with Lucky, you know, I'm sure we'll retain relevance for years to come, but we hate that because
I hope we're looking at it in 10 years and saying, wow, that was so crazy.
I know.
I'm so glad we don't live in that reality anymore.
I know.
That's my hope.
Fingers crossed. Well, I think that's as good a note to end on as any. This has been a great conversation, Natasha. Thank you so much for being on Switchblade Sisters and talking about Strange Days. This was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me talk about one of my most favorite movies. I hope they re-release it and everybody can see it soon.
Cameron, get on it.
Yeah, get on it. Get out of the water, bro.
Exactly. Thank you so much for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you'd like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
No, I hate the zap. When they die, it just brings down your whole day.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.